Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Much attention is given rightly to national politics, which admittedly is riveting these days. But there's also a lot happening at the state level, often under the radar. Our guest today is an expert in progressive policy and politics at the state level. Sam Munger is the Director of Strategic Engagement and Senior Advisor at the State Innovation Exchange, which supports progressive state legislators. He began his political career while still in high school as a volunteer on the 1992 Clinton campaign and has been working in policy and politics ever since. Sam's experience includes working as an analyst for a Democratic polling firm, a legislative researcher for a national consumer advocacy watchdog, a researcher for The Nation magazine, and for John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign. He was a founding member and head of outreach for the American Legislative Issue Campaign Exchange, known as ALICE, a project to develop an online library of model and exemplary laws and to provide legislative research support to state legislators. From 2008 to 2014, he was managing director of the Center for State Innovation, which provided policy resources and technical help to governors and state and local policymakers. He holds a JD law degree from the New York University School of Law and currently lives in Madison, Wisconsin with his family. Sam Munger, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks so much, Eleanor. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I run into quite a few people who are unfamiliar with the State Innovation Exchange, so I want you to just say right off the bat, describe what is the State Innovation Exchange, what do you all do there at the State Innovation Exchange?
Sure. Well, I'll say that's somewhat by design, and we can get into why that is later, but put relatively simply, the State Innovation Exchange, or SIX as we call it for short, with exchange beginning with X, I suppose, in that acronym, we are a sort of multifaceted support and resource for state legislators in particular, progressive state legislators, and in general, we try to both advance a pretty wide range of progressive policy at the state level and to build in a long-term, sustainable way progressive power and the ability to, to sort of essentially shape a progressive future at the state level, precisely to push back on some of the negative trends that you alluded to in the introduction and to try to help foster some of the good things that we see happening at the state level. And there are some.
Yeah, absolutely. And how long has the State Innovation Exchange been around?
Well, we're a relatively young organization. I still think of us as, sort of in our toddler phase, if you will, if not infancy. We were founded really at the very tail end of 2014, beginning of 2015. So we're just over two and a half years old, which, in the world of political projects is significant that we've managed to stick around. In the world as a whole, that's really not that long to have been building. And we, I think we were founded in response to the perception of some of the, let's say, conservative dominance at the state level, frankly, and to push back on some of the trends that folks had seen. So we're
right,
a relatively
exactly.
recent project.
Well, it strikes me that it was really progressives got out early on state and local policy, trying to get some model legislation that state legislators could use around the country. And going back to the 1970s, we had the Conference on State and Local Alternative Policies. So it was progressives who were out in front with it, but then we kind of stumbled with that. ALEC came along, the right-wing group, and has been extremely well-funded and well-organized. Tell us, I want to talk about both those issues. I want to talk first about what is ALEC now and what are they doing, and also what happened with the prior efforts similar to what you're doing now and how you learn from them. But let's start, for people who don't know about it, what is this ALEC group from the right wing?
Yeah, I was going to, sometimes I reference them as a, you know, as a, use them as a reference point for describing what Six does, because in most respects, they're much better known and much bigger and better financed.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just, I'll just contradict you a little bit when I say that ALEC was actually founded, I believe, slightly before CASLP, slightly before the Conference on Alternative State and Local Policy. Yeah, because ALEC dates back to, I mean, a memo, this famous Powell Memorandum that was written in 1972. CASLP, I think, wasn't founded until the mid to late 70s up in Amherst, Mass. By Pierre Clavel. But, and we still, I should say, still have in our archives the documents and the records from the Conference of Alternative State and Local Policy.
Fantastic.
You know, PDF images of mimeographed, you know, notebook pages from back then. But anyway, so you're absolutely right. There was, irrespective, I think your broad point remains, which is that progressives have been at this for almost as long as conservatives, are just about exactly the same amount, and yet conservatives have been much more successful, I think, by pretty much all measures. And ALEC really is, at least for the state legislative sphere, the kind of epitome or, you know, apotheosis of that. It's ALEC stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a, you know, sort of purposely anodyne acronym that doesn't really tell you a lot about what they do. What they essentially do, well, they're, as I said, they've been around, you know, for about 40 years now, since the early 70s. They were founded essentially, you know, out of a reaction to the perception that progressives had really, or, you know, mm-hmm. as it was seen then, the civil rights movement and the sexual revolution had really been, had been very successful, and that conservatives and corporate America needed to push back. And so there was, you know, something of a, if you want to call it, a little bit of an unholy alliance of corporate and social conservatives that came together in the form of Lewis Powell, who was, went on to become a Supreme Court justice, but at that time worked for the Chamber of Commerce and other folks at the Chamber of Commerce, and Paul Weyrich, who was an important figure in the social conservative and sort of movement conservative politics. So they were founded then. They, as they've evolved, they are, you know, something like a on paper, $10 million a year organization, though some estimates, some researchers have suggested that they leverage, you know, closer to $200 or $300 million when you include the sort of effectively the corporate in-kind contributions that they get, or the amount of resources they leverage in corporate power. And the way that they do that is that they get together, they do this, you know, they're known at any rate, let's say, for their conferences, right? And their conferences tend to draw these days, oh, you know, close to 1,000, just south of 1,000 state legislators, which is a significant proportion of those in the country. There are 7,283 state legislators, or 284, I can't remember, the number changes a little bit based on some rules, as everyone knows off the top of their head, of course. So, you know, 1,000 of them is quite a lot. In some states there, a majority of the state legislature are ALEC members. They're a formal membership organization, though their membership fees are nominal and they're usually waived or paid by the state. So it isn't really, that's not really where their money comes from. And they get these legislators together, and they essentially act as a sort of corporate matchmaking service. They, you know, get legislators in a room with corporate lobbyists, with folks representing, you know, many, if not most, of the large Fortune 500 companies in the country. They do it in committee, sort of committee formats by subject. The corporate, whoever, you know, essentially whichever corporation pays the most, but, you know, their corporate donors act as the committee chair, and they get to bring up pieces of, you know, legislation, model legislation, essentially, and vote on them, and then hand them off to the legislators who show up there and ask them to go back in their state and pass them. And, you know, they do it in a sort of a very both, you know, a kind of comprehensive way, and in a way that's very appealing for state legislators, when you consider that the vast majority of state legislators are in the country are incredibly under-resourced. It's essentially a, you know, a model that dates back to the sort of citizen legislator concept in the late 1700s and early 1800s. You know, these folks sometimes meet for 3 months, 90 days every 2 years. They have, you know, essentially no staff in most states. They don't draw regular paychecks, so they all have to have other jobs. So, you know, if only
I just want to emphasize for our listeners that a lot of the people who work in the state legislatures, they might know one or two issues really well, or even a few, but that they're called on to vote on these multi-million dollar issues that they may know little or nothing about, and they don't really have the money for staff to support them. So they become heavily reliant on a group that says, hey, we can make this easy on you. Here's what the policy is, and here's how you can be voting on it. And ALEC poses as a nonpartisan organization. They claim to be nonpartisan, but they're actually, you know, a lot of right-wing money behind it. So I think what's, you know, the importance of what you're talking about here for our listeners to know is this group, ALEC, the right-wing organization, is supporting the state legislators with right-wing policies, although they're kind of disguised as nonpartisan.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think, and you headed right where I was, which is that, well, so let's come back to their politics in a minute, but that, you know, they have this very appealing proposition, which is that these legislators show up, you know, from their dry cleaning business or their sheep ranch or whatever they do in their, you know, in their ordinary lives. They come in pretty cold. As you said, they may know a couple issues based on their you know, their line of work or based on their things that have come up locally, if they have local office. But often they know issues very well, and certainly they don't know the broad scope. And so on their first day, they're met by a fellow legislator or representative of ALEC who says, look, you know, I know you're feeling a little confused. I've got just the answer. Come meet with these guys. You know, they'll show you the ropes. Mm-hmm. They're going to give you a packet of great, you know, bills that you should pass. They're going to show up with corporate lobbyists and, you know, organize testimony when you need it. Those corporate lobbyists are going to help you get it passed. They're going to lead you through the process. And then when you're done, you know, we'll arrange a little fundraiser off-site so that you can, and they'll make sure to show up there and get you money for your reelection. And, you know, you'll never have to worry about anything again, right? Just come to this meeting. So, you know, that's a pretty appealing deal. Yes, you're absolutely right in terms of their ideology, right? I mean, ALEC is, they are, at this point, technically nonpartisan. They're a 501c3. They were the subject of litigation several years ago and of complaints to the IRS that they were actually doing lobbying under the guise of a 501c3, so illegal, you know, lobbying and advocacy, and had to split off part of their organization. So at this point, ALEC itself is in fact a 501c3. They're technically nonpartisan. I mean, in fact, they are, because, I suppose, in some sense, because they're in fact, you know, I would have said, up until quite recently, right of the Republican Party. They are a group that is funded by, you know, the biggest corporate actors, by ExxonMobil, by Pfizer, by the big pharmaceutical companies, by the big banking industry, and they're funded very significantly by folks like the Koch brothers and the Mercers and the DeVos family and these, like, you know, the sort of big money, the Bradley Foundation, you know, the usual suspects on the right, and that has led them to outflank the Republican Party to the right in a lot of respects. So, for instance, one of their notable their infamous policy interventions, notable, I suppose, successes from their perspective, is that they took a bill proposed by an obscure, a retired head of the state NRA in Florida that was, you know, initially called a sort of enhanced self-defense bill and came to be called Stand Your Ground. This passed in the Florida legislature, was brought to an ALEC conference. They made it one of their top priorities. They decided this was a great idea. And within a really short period of time, and I have like a, you know, when I do my PowerPoint about six, there's a map that shows all the states lighting up. It was introduced in 38 states. So it went from one state to 38 states in a matter of a few years, which in legislative terms is really, you know, lightning fast. It didn't pass in all of those states, and then some of them have walked it back in the wake of the Trayvon Martin shooting and, you know, ensuing scandal. Mm-hmm. But this was, you know, this was a piece of legislation that was, you know, on the sort of extremes of even gun advocacy, right? This was not something mm-hmm. that even gun advocates thought was a particularly good idea at the time, but ALEC was out in front on it. In general, they are, you know, they're very aligned with corporate polluters and energy interests. They're very aligned with deregulatory entities, you know, the banking industry, certainly folks who want to, the fracking industry, folks who want to violate environmental regulations, you know. In the past, they've been very pro-incarceration. We can talk about where they are in criminal justice now because that's shifted a little. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've been very, very effective, I think. And, you know, that's partly a testament to their work and their funding, and partly a testament to the fact that progressives left that field a little bit unoccupied.
Exactly. So now to our rescue comes the State Innovation Exchange. And you know, we had some activities, you know, the 70s, 80s, a couple of other groups. then the progressives kind of left the field, it seems, for the working at the state level like this. But you folks have come along and really put together an excellent organization here. So tell our listeners why we should not abandon hope and ALEC doesn't run the world at the state level and that we're actually on the field competing now. What are you all doing at the state level for progressives?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So like I said, we're basically in our third year, and we just held our third annual conference. As I said, ALEC draws, just maybe under 1,800 state legislators across the country to their conference. Our first year that we did our conference, we had 100 state legislators there, which, by the way, ALEC at their very first conference back in the 70s had about, 20, which didn't stop the conservative movement from plugging millions and millions of dollars a year into them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had about 100. Our second year, we had, just over 200. I'm wrong, actually, because we held one conference in 2014. This was our fourth. Anyway, this year we were up over 500 legislators and staff, which,
mm-hmm.
as I said, is a not insignificant number weighed against the number of, progressives all across, of legislators that there are across the country. There's only, a few thousand. They were drawn from all 50 states. In many states, we have relationships with either the leadership or the ranking minority members. Our network as a whole, we don't have formal membership in the way that ALEC does. We don't require people to buy in. We don't require them to sign any pledges. So we essentially count as our network or as our members folks who are in regular communication with us or have taken some action, but is over 2,000 legislators who have, either introduced a bill, been on a phone call, signed a sign-on letter, been part of a working group, or come to one of our many in-person events. So we feel like we've gotten pretty good penetration in terms of making contact with state legislators. I think more broadly speaking, we've had some really encouraging policy successes. We've had some both in terms of introducing positive legislation and in stopping negative legislation. We've gotten really, really positive feedback from, the sort of entire progressive universe throughout the states. And I think, it's so hard to say what has caused a particular election to occur in 2010 when mm-hmm. conservatives really took over, solidified their control or cemented their control, let's say, at the state level. There were tons of things that contributed to that election. It was off cycle, which is never that good for Democrats. There was the first black president, and there was a huge backlash. It was a bad map. We were just coming out of a recession. In this last election, where we saw progressives really, sweep to pretty significant and unexpectedly significant wins in Virginia, in New Jersey, in other, special elections, which are much smaller all over the country. I think there were lots of things that contributed to that, but I like to think that, some of the kinds of supports that we offer, which are, to be clear, during session, we're not funding campaigns, we're not active directly in campaigns, but that, we've shown that progressives can actually rack up policy wins, they can actually be effective, and that there are supports for them when they're in office, contributed to folks' willingness to put them in some small way. As I said, I don't want to take credit for all the hard work that folks put into, say, the Virginia elections. But I think they're unquestionably signs of life. I also think just institutionally, six is, we're in order of magnitude. We're not nearly as big as ALEC or Americans for Prosperity yet, but we're an order of magnitude larger than, several orders of magnitude larger than an effort like the Congress on Alternative State and Local Policy, which was really, a sort of ragtag group of academics and activists. We have a professional staff of over 25. By the end of this year, early next year, we will have staff on the ground in roughly a dozen states across the country. We are using the sort of the latest cutting edge public opinion research and modeling. We work with, most or all of the leading think tanks and policy organizations and advocacy organizations in particular areas across the country. I think, and there are other, to be fair, there are many other progressive entities, pieces of the progressive infrastructure that have come online since the 70s, since the 80s and 90s, and even, frankly, since, you know, throughout the 2000s. I mean, there was a big, there was a wave of sort of a reaction to what happened in 2004 when John Kerry lost. There was a real sort of taking stock that was done on the left, and several important entities were created then as well that, you know, support different pieces of the progressive movement at the state level, grassroots, electoral, voter participation, policy work, and so on. So, you know, I think in many ways that there's, you know, there's a variety of reasons to be hopeful. The landscape is different in some good ways and some bad ways. I'm certainly not meaning to sugarcoat things. But, you know, for your and your audience's sake, trying to take the optimistic view, the entities are different at the state level. There's a much higher degree of organization on the left. And I think, you know, there are some positive trends demographically and politically that, you know, lead me to be hopeful for 2018 and for 2020. And if 2020 goes well, then certainly I think there's a lot of possibilities beyond there. But obviously, it's a long view. So it took conservatives roughly, you know, 40-ish years or two generations to move from the era of Nixon when they had historic minorities at the state and federal level to now, when they have, you know, they've solidified their control at every level of government. And it may take us, you know, I hope it doesn't take that long, but it may take progressives, you know, many years, might take a generation to work that back.
Possibly, although the recent elections, as you say, were very encouraging, and there looks like there could be a big Democratic wave coming now. You mentioned about the policy successes, both introducing positive legislation in the past or is being considered, and mm-hmm. then blocking some of the negative policies that are out there. Let's start with, what are some of the positive policies that you have kind of put forward or helped to spread around the country?
Sure. Yeah, so I think, I mean, really, it's, you know, many, many more than I could go into on this phone call. But, you know, to take an example, we 2 years ago, we engaged in what we called an Equal Pay Week of Action or Equal Pay Day of Action, in which we worked with, you know, legislators and what ended up being and partners and advocacy groups in over 30 states to all introduce and or, you know, introduce or move or have action on equal pay legislation in their respective state houses. And we ended up, you know, part of the reason that ended up going so well is that it was during the 2016, at the outset of the 2016 presidential election, and Hillary Clinton retweeted it, and the Sanders campaign retweeted it, and it got picked up and became sort of part of the presidential dialogue, and that obviously was a great echo chamber for that. So, and just for instance, that took an equal pay bill in a state like Oklahoma, a really, really red state, or Utah. You know, and if an equal pay bill is introduced by, you know, a couple progressive legislators in a state like Oklahoma, on its own, you know, it would drop without a trace, right? It's not going to move. There would be very little attention paid by the press. And, you know, in general, you wouldn't see the needle move at all. By wrapping it into this larger movement and shining a huge national light on it, the Oklahoma legislators were interviewed by the Washington Post, by Politico, you know, there was this national profile. It generated a huge amount of momentum. They did several local press events as part of that too, all of which we were able to help support and connect them in general, you know, to the national and local press. That bill came within basically, you know, it passed both chambers and just ran out of time before it was passed by the governor, and then the following year it was passed. In Utah,
in which
that same
state?
Year, that was Oklahoma.
Deep red state of Oklahoma, or you
in the deep
came
red state of Oklahoma, and you know, I don't want to overstate it. It was a, you know, it was a modest, you know, it wasn't the most cutting edge progressive equal pay legislation in the entire country, but it was, you know, it was real progress. And the same in Utah, there was, you know,
wow, involved. That's impressive.
I mean, it, right, and it, you know, it isn't, unless you're really paying attention, right, and you're this sort of wonky person who reads the, you know, the back pages of the Washington Post, A23 or whatever, you wouldn't know, or you read the Oklahoma paper, you wouldn't know that this had passed, and you wouldn't know that the Utah legislation had passed. And in some ways, that's for the best, right? It's, we're not trying to grab headlines, and that's, you know, that's part of, when you said many folks you talked to had not heard of the State Innovation Exchange. I mean, in truth, we are, you know, we're not trying to be the face of most of what we do. We're trying to make legislators more effective, progressive legislators more effective at their jobs on the theory that if they're successful at their jobs, it will, and, you know, propose legislation, good legislation that is popular, that passes, it will help them build credibility, it will help them build power themselves, whether that means, you know, moving up in the ranks within their legislature, whether it means becoming more popular with their constituents, or whether it means running for higher office. When they build more power, they're able to pass more and better legislation and build more power and rinse and repeat on the way up. And it really, you know, we want them to be the face of this and we want them to take the credit for it. It you know, it works much better if your local legislator is the face of the equal pay legislation than if it's some, you know, shadowy, progressive national group. We're not actually based in Washington, D.C. I myself am in Madison, but, you know, for the sake of argument, let's say D.C.-based, you know, Soros-funded entity. We don't get money from George Soros either, but, you know, if we did, or I'm sure, you know, that's sort of the category we would fall into, then if that's the face of the legislation. So, you know, it's intentionally, we're intentionally somewhat, you know, subdued, especially when it comes to the particular pieces of legislation, intentionally, I should say, somewhat, you know, behind the scenes when it comes to the particular pieces of legislation. I'll just give you another quick example, and then if there are particular topics that you're interested in, we can talk about those. But another is, it's a policy reform called automatic voter registration, which mm-hmm. basically describes changing the motor voter setup that we have currently, where when you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, you are offered the option to register to vote if you are not. All automatic voter registration does is it changes it to an opt-out rather than an opt-in. So rather than being offered the opportunity to register to vote, you are told, you know, you're said, you're going to, you know, if you, by completing this, you're going to be registered to vote, and just let us know if you don't, if you would not like to be, or if you're not eligible to vote. And that simple change resulted in, when implemented in Oregon, it resulted in several hundred thousand more people being registered to vote. And we know that, you know, we need to work on getting folks to turn out as well, but we know that when people are registered to vote, they turn out at a, you know, at a greater than 60% rate, and so, you know, that results in a lot more voters. That has passed in California, too, and the data on how many new voters have been registered isn't in yet, but some estimates were as high as 3 million, California being such a big state. That went from one state, Oregon, which passed it in, I think, either 2014 or 15. It's now eight states have passed it, and some of the biggest states in the country, California, Illinois. And, you know, I think within a few years we'll probably, we've been working really hard on that with voting rights advocates, and I think we'll see that pass in a number of states. It's good government. It costs less to register people electronically than to have the old-fashioned paper forms. It reduces the error rate if you have folks in an electronic database. And it results in more people voting. So, you know, I think it's positive on pretty much every front. And, you know, like I said, I think it's something that around which there's real energy and momentum. If, you know, not the sort that garners the Trump tweet headlines that that tend to get written about at the national level.
Right, exactly. Well, that's very exciting about that automatic voter registration because we know that's where the right-wing Republicans are really pushing to knock people off of the voting, to make it harder mm-hmm. for low-income people, people of color, make it harder for them to vote because it seems to be the best way for them to make sure the Republicans win is to make sure the Democrats aren't allowed to vote. So that leads directly to some of the work that needs to be done to stop some of the negative things happening at the state level where the Republicans are trying to block voting. I mean, to me, a very anti-democratic activities that they're engaged in. What do you see as some of the negative bills that the Republicans are trying to push that are out there, and what are you able to do to try and counter them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the story of the last 6 or 7 years now, the last three cycles since 2010, has really been of a wave of legislation attempting to, you know, undermine regulatory safeguards, you know, increase inequality, reduce any restraints on corporations, reduce, you know, the ability of states to raise revenue, and so on. And it's happened on so many fronts that you can, you know, possibly run through it all in one phone call. Environmental safeguards being undone, attacks on reproductive freedom, attacks on civil rights, attacks on the rights of LGBTQ citizens in particular. I think that one area, I mean, to sort of seize on the one that you mentioned first, and I think because in some ways it's fundamental to everything else, there's been a really concerted set of attacks on the, what I think of as the sort of small-d democratic mechanisms for people to express their preferences and for people to sort of make their voice heard in the public sphere. And so that certainly includes voter suppression, right? And you see a whole range of kinds of voter suppression efforts, everything from voter ID to purges, draconian, sloppy, sort of intentionally sloppy purges of the voter rolls, reductions in the ability to early vote, reductions in the ability to absentee vote, and at the federal level, the sunsetting of the Voting Rights Act and then the, concomitant shutting down of voting centers in predominantly poor and minority areas that really made it much more inaccessible. But I think, to see that, and that has gotten some press for sure, and I think it should, properly so, but to see that as a sort of in isolation as attacks on, that's just the attacks on the ability of, partisan attacks on Democrats, let's say, or even attacks on minority voters is really to miss part of the picture, because I think Republicans since, and I should say conservatives really, since 2010 have sort of systematically gone after the ability of people to make any kind of, electoral or democratic change at the governmental level and especially in the state level. So, in 2010, they won this pretty heavy majority for reasons, a lot of reasons, some of which I had touched on before, but there was this huge sea change election. And in the wake of that, as we well know, they just absolutely, it was a decennial redistricting year because it was 2010. So they had the opportunity to redraw the lines, and they just, using the latest modern technology, gerrymandered the bejesus out of every state that they could, and especially the battleground states, right? You don't necessarily need to gerrymander a state like Utah. There's only one population center, and it's, 80% Republican, or 60 or 70. But a state
and
like
just
Pennsylvania,
our listeners, in case they're wondering, if they haven't heard that term, gerrymandering, that's where the political people get together and draw the lines to say where the districts will be. And those district lines can be drawn in such a way to favor one party over the other. And that's why in a lot of states you run into a situation where more of the people might have voted for Democrats, but you'll see a majority of representatives from the Republican Party just from where the lines are drawn in the districts.
That's right. I mean, I guess I hope most of your listeners are familiar with gerrymandering at this point. It's been such a national topic of conversation. But just, to throw out a few examples, in my home state of Wisconsin, two cycles ago, at the state level, Democrats won 200,000 more votes, which is pretty significant. There's about 2 million votes cast in the state, so 200,000 is about 10%. And yet they had a 19-seat minority in the assembly. So 200,000 more popular votes, 19 fewer seats. And this is exactly true in the U.S. Congress as well. Democrats in the last few cycles have won, somewhere between 1.5 and 3.5 million more votes than Republicans, and yet Republicans hold this 50-seat majority in the House, right? I mean, that, it's hard to wrap your head around. More people voted for Democrats, 50 more Republicans out of 400. So, I mean, it's incredibly anti-democratic, and it's layered on top of the sort of, some of the somewhat anti-democratic features of our Constitution originally, like the Senate, where, Wyoming gets the same number of votes as California. So you have this problem of gerrymandering, which has made it virtually impossible for Democrats and progressives to win sustainable majorities in many, many states that are either closely divided or in which Democrats actually get a majority of the votes. But on top of that, you also see increasingly in the open and sort of boldly Republicans and conservatives taking aim at some of the other ways that, the sort of core ways that we think of people making their voices heard. So there have been a wave, and this really came to light in the wake of Charlottesville, of attacks on the right of people to assemble and protest publicly. And I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar, but, there were a dozen states this last session that tried to put in place restrictions on the right to protest, saying either that you couldn't gather in front of public buildings, or that you could only, you could only gather at certain times. That some of them even went so far as to, and this is what really folks focused on after Charlottesville, reduce penalties on motorists for hitting protesters, for striking protesters with their car.
I haven't heard of that one. That's disgusting.
It's amazing, right? That was proposed in several states, including Georgia, including Tennessee. And that was, you know, that was true. They were proposed before Charlottesville, and they only came to light to some degree after that. Also, Minnesota, I should say, had a bill of that sort that was proposed. And, you know, it came very close to passage in a number of places. My hope is that it's lost a little bit of momentum, but I see no reason to think that other sorts of restrictions on the right to protest won't come up again next session. There also have been efforts to restrict the ability of folks to put popular initiatives on the ballot. So, we I think are often familiar with the ballot initiative process, say in a state like California, where you get things like Prop 13 or Prop 287. Prop 13 was the property taxes. 287 was the anti-immigrant. I may have that backwards, but proposition. But at any rate, you know the ability of people essentially to exercise popular democracy to short circuit the legislature. Because, you know, that would be another way, that'd be another check on the ability of conservatives and state legislators to do whatever they want. We certainly see attacks on the judiciary. I mean, we see rhetorical attacks, right, from our commander-in-chief on down. But in a state like North Carolina, when a Democrat won the gubernatorial election, the Republican in the legislature immediately tried to court pack, essentially, just like FDR back in the New Deal, and, you know, just like what was rejected by the American people in the Supreme Court. But they tried to add a bunch of new justices that would have been appointed by the Republican governor to deny the Democratic governor the ability to appoint a majority of the court. There have been all sorts of efforts to change the way that judges are elected, to move it to an appointment system, if that's helpful, or to move it to an election system, if Republicans think they can win or rig those elections, to change contribution rules so that lobbyists can give money to, and people with interest in front of the court can give money to judges to get elected, which seems like an obvious opportunity for corruption, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've gone after the third branch of government, and you know, as well, they've gone after, let's say, they've gone out of their way to restrict the ability of cities and municipalities to govern what they themselves do. So we've seen a lot of instances in which cities, which increasingly tend to be, they both are increasingly progressive in that they're getting younger, more diverse, bigger. These are urban areas. They're also growing and are becoming more affluent compared to the rest of states and compared to sort of ex-urban and rural areas. They also have become increasingly assertive and sort of increasingly innovative about trying to change the rules at the local level. So passing local living wages or paid sick days for city employees or soda taxes or, you know, a whole range of other, sort of innovative policies, which tend to be on the progressive side, but in, you know, the truest American tradition are sort of a part of the laboratories of democracy, right? They're trying out things at the city level that they think will work for their citizens. And states, because of the way our federal system is constructed, states have a lot of power over cities. And so you've seen conservatives at the state level prevent cities from exercising their own democratic power over their own city rules that govern what they can do at the city level. And I think all of these are really of a piece. They're ways of preventing citizens from exercising their fundamental democratic rights to speak out, to govern themselves, and they're, you know, sort of systematically trying to kick away the various checks that would prevent the conservatives that are in power at the state level and at the federal level from continuing unchecked, from never having to face this competitive election, from never having to face judicial scrutiny, from never having to deal with people at the local level who are protesting or who are trying to pass their own laws. And I think it should really frighten everyone, including, I should say, people across the ideological spectrum. Some of these anti-protest bills have been opposed by the Tea Party. Republican mayors of cities, conservative mayors of cities have shown up to speak out on behalf of their ability to pass laws. So it's not even something that's favored by folks on the right, frankly. It's only favored by those in power, by the legislators themselves.
Right, and we've seen such a dramatic example of what you're talking about. I think it's one of the most dangerous trends in the country right now is exactly what you're talking about. These efforts are very anti-democratic to restrict the rights of citizens to protest, even the rights of mayors to govern. We saw this whole thing about where the states could suspend the mayors and the council, the locally elected people, and be given a manager who had dictatorial powers in Michigan, when the Republican governor of Michigan used his authority, passed by the Republicans in the state house, to just say to the mayor and the city council, really, you're outgunned here, and you're no longer in charge. I'm putting someone who is in charge. And then they make all kinds of decisions that the people may hate and not want, but they're not, those people have the authority. So it, to me, it's anti-constitutional. It's so anti-American. But as long as the Republicans can pass these bills at the state level, it becomes the standing law. And some of them might be able to be challenged in court as unconstitutional, but it's a huge attack on our rights and liberties as citizens. So I'm so glad that you, Sam, and your colleagues at the State Innovation Exchange are aware of this and working on it. What do you think we can do to stop them?
Well, that's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right to point to that, you know, the appointment of emergency managers, which is not limited to Michigan. That's true in other states as well. In Pennsylvania, for instance, an emergency manager was appointed for Harrisburg and completely botched up what they did in that city. In Michigan, it led to the Flint water crisis, and we had one of the first people to identify that, a local pediatrician, Dr. Mona Hatta-Tisha, speak at one of our conferences last year, and she was incredibly moving. And the stories there, you would think would put this idea to bed forever. But when people are committed to not see the evidence, then I guess they won't see it. So, mm-hmm. What can folks do? I mean, I think I wish I could say I had a silver bullet, but I think in the end, what it takes is sort of good old-fashioned involvement on the, and sort of public involvement, public protest, folks getting engaged. And, I think that's something that the left has been good at historically and maybe had forgotten a little bit about. And you've seen that, that sense of desire, the energy really reinvigorated, I think, in the current moment. But I guess what I would encourage folks is to say, is to get involved, not just to focus at the federal level, because I think that's a mistake that progressives have made. Really, I would say, back as far as the civil rights movement, or maybe even the Civil War. Right? There's been this sense that states were sort of retrograde, where states' rights was sort of synonymous with conservatism, with anti-civil rights. States were the place where, where good policy went to die, and the federal government was sort of the agent of change and of progressivism and of expanding rights, sometimes at the point of a National Guard rifle, in the case of Alabama and George Wallace. So I think there's been a lot of focus on the federal level. We tend to get really fired up around presidential elections. We tend to get really fired up around around opposing a president, sort of reckless, amoral president like our current one, and opposing Congress. But at the state and local level, there are huge opportunities for engagement, and your engagement goes a lot further. I mean, if you go to your typical town council meeting, even in a city, I'm in a sort of medium-sized city where local government is pretty accessible, and it's a city that tends to be, it's historically known for its activism, right? Madison, Wisconsin, it's a pretty engaged citizenry. But if you go to your typical, city council hearing, if you go to your local alder's office hours, there's no one there. I mean, not at the city council meeting, there's a handful of people. Local alder, no one sometimes. I mean, people, these local officials are accessible. They are accountable to you. And, they... they are open to your input, or should be, and I think in most cases, in my experience, are. The same with your state legislatures. Your state legislators, and your state legislatures broadly. You know, in smaller states, state legislator might represent, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 people. But again, if you, you know, most of those people don't, you know, aren't in touch. They don't write. They don't call. They don't email. They don't show up at offices. They don't show up at hearings or press press events. You know, there's a few. There's usually, again, in my experience, you know, in any given legislator's district, there's like three or four people who write, call, show up about everything, but the vast majority of people don't bother. And I think if folks are disturbed by the ability of a governor of a state to unilaterally remove the elected officials that govern a major city in that state, the second biggest city, appoint someone of their choosing who promptly botches the policy decisions because of their lack of knowledge of the locality, precisely why they shouldn't be appointed, resulting in the poisoning of tens of thousands of children. If that's a, you know, if that's a disturbing scenario for folks, then I encourage them to get involved. And obviously, organizing and voting is important too. You should all register. You should all learn where your precinct is. And everyone listening to this radio call should go and vote. But, you know, get involved in other parts of the democratic process. Go to a hearing. Go testify. Call your legislator's office. Write them a letter. You know, show up at a public rally. There are numerous opportunities. There are both, you know, the schedules for almost every legislature public hearings are going to be on their website. There's a group called the Town Hall Project. I encourage you to go look them up. They started by listing all the town halls that that members of Congress were holding on repealing the ACA, which resulted in them promptly stopping town halls. They're expanding into state legislative hearings in a number of states, and we're working with them. And obviously groups like Indivisible or United We Stand or the Women's March Group. Those are really, you know, those are good and important ways to get involved and to make your voice heard.
Exactly right. And just to be clear for our listeners, the example you gave of the governor having the right to put in his own manager and to basically negate the local elected mayor and city council, that actually is a real life story that did happen in Michigan, and that was what was behind the problem with the tainted water, the poison water, where now, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people got poisoned by the water because of decisions made by this guy appointed by the governor from outside. So these are not hypothetical concerns of potential horror stories. These are real life stories of what's happening in America today. And what I see happening is people so much take for granted that, oh, well, you know, the government will take care of us, or this would, you know, those kinds of things wouldn't happen in America. Well, those kinds of things are happening in America. I mean, you had the Nazis marching in the streets in Virginia, and you have the President of the United States going, well, you know, there's good people on both sides, you know, refusing to take a stand against the Nazis and the white supremacists. So it's incredible if you read historically how quickly rights can be taken away from people if they're not vigilant. In another context, to quote some, an eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. We have to be engaged in our government at the state and local level, at the national level, or we could lose very quickly within a matter of months and years some of the things that we've taken for granted since the founding of the country. So I'm ever so grateful, Sam, for the great work you're doing at the State Innovation Exchange. And you're oriented mostly towards supporting the state legislators, right? So like if listeners want to take action, they don't independently kind of connect through with you. You're focused on the legislators. But you mentioned some of the groups people can go to, like Indivisible, the Women's March, and the Town Hall Project.
That's right, and that's a good way to get involved at the grassroots level and locally. I think, you know, that we do tend to be a, you know, as they sometimes say, grass tops focused. We're, you know, we're trying to support the legislators themselves. We do, you know, part of a fundamental tenet of our work is to make those legislators both more in touch with, more accountable to, more more open to their constituents, and I think we do that in a whole variety of ways. You know, we've done a lot of seminars teaching legislators, you know, how but how to use Facebook, right, on some level. I mean, if you think about, I have a Facebook page. I'm not particularly savvy about how to use it, and without giving my exact age, you know, I turned 40 pretty recently. You know, legislators, by and large, are the median age is significantly older than me. These are not people who grew up in the Facebook era, who grew up in the social media era, let alone, you know, Facebook and Twitter and so on. It's not a second language. It's not innate to them. And yet, that increasingly is a way that their constituents expect to connect. Website, Facebook, Twitter, sometimes, you know, some of these other platforms, Vine and, you know, your sort of like video sharing platforms. You know, I think it's a really powerful way that legislators can connect with their constituents if they know it's there, if they know how to use it, if they're comfortable with it. You know, you can show live video of things. You can allow people to sign a petition and then, you know, update them when the piece of legislation that they're interested in moves. So that's just one way. I think we also, you know, we really are trying to encourage people of all sorts of different, diverse, racial, ethnic, economic backgrounds to run for office. We're trying to create leadership opportunities at the legislative level for folks of all a really diverse set of backgrounds. I mean, in all these ways, we're hoping to make legislators more open and accountable to their citizens. But you are right, we don't typically, you know, we're not the group where you put in your zip code and we help you email your legislator immediately. But we can put you in touch with those groups. I encourage you to just go to, you know, in most states, if you're in Michigan, if you go to michigan.gov, there'll be a portal, there'll be a website. If you're in Wisconsin, wisconsin.gov, there'll be a tab for the legislature. In every state, the legislature, I believe, legislators are required to have a publicly accessible email address. Now, that may not go directly to them. In some states, it does. You know, in small states, their email address is right there. You can email your legislator tomorrow, and it'll actually go to their email account. In lots of states, they, you know, there's an assistant who collects them, or it goes to a sort of central clearinghouse, and they pass it through. You know, if it's not crazy, and if it's not a whatever, you know, sort of rant or a threat or a spam. And so, you know, it's really quite easy to get in touch with your local legislator. And I really encourage you to do so. They, like I said, in most states, you know, the 40 out of 50 states, the legislators read their email personally because they just don't get that many. You know, and at least they, you know, they scan it and they will respond to it. So, and are responsive and you know, keep track of what people say. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, overstate it. Obviously, you know, they have a lot of, there's lots of things they're dealing with and they're responding to a lot of stimuli, but you know, they really do. It really does make a difference. If a dozen people from, you know, their district, if you're a constituent, they'll take your voice seriously because, again, like I said, their districts are not that huge. They can't afford to ignore one outspoken person who may, you know, talk to their neighbors, who may have an influential voice or position. You know, that's a real number of votes that they need. That's real support. So, yeah, I really do encourage folks to get in touch, not necessarily through us, though you're welcome to go to our website. You can see the resources there. You can see, I think our website will give you some good information about what's going on at the state level, about what some of the trends are, about what some of the interesting kinds of legislation that are passing, you know, what some of the innovative things are that state legislators are doing. But if you do, you know, if you want to get in touch directly, I encourage you go to yourstate.gov or go to any one of your, you know, the sort of good government groups locally, the League of Women Voters, League of Conservation Voters, you know, the Sierra Club, Planned Parenthood. They will all have list of your local legislators. They'd be happy to help you get in touch. So I think there's a lot folks can do.
That's fantastic. Really appreciate all that good work, Sam, good direction for people. And we just have 1 minute left. I'm wondering, you're in the front lines and you're watching the profound influence of the dark money on the state level. And by the way, we haven't had a chance to talk about it, but you'll have to have you come back. And that book, Dark Money, which I think is required reading for all Americans. Yeah, by Jane Mayer, who's a friend and classmate of mine from college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, awesome woman. And I hope all our listeners have read Dark Money. But you're seeing the impact of this dark money happening in all the anti-democratic activities that take place and then all the negative policies that spring from it. What gives you hope?
Well, it's funny, you know, having said all those positive things about how people can get involved, you know, to turn to the topic of dark money, which really is corrosive and is pernicious, I think, you know, one of the things that gives me hope is despite the tide, you know, is that you still see positive things happening, you know, despite the tide of dark money that, is focused on both, you know, eating away at our democracy, at passing regressive policies, and frankly, keeping people in the dark, right? I mean, we've seen that really, really starkly in the last election. There are, and I don't just mean Russia, you know, like there were lots and lots of money went into giving misinformation to people about where candidates stood, about what was really going on in the world, about what's real news and what's fake news, and that's, you know, that's not by accident. And despite all of that, despite the fact that it's way disproportionately on one side of the ideological spectrum, you still see, you know, 15 new progressives elected in Virginia. You still see, progressive governor reelected in Virginia. You see, really progressive African-American lieutenant governor elected in Virginia. You see a progressive governor elected in New Jersey. And you see equal pay legislation passed. You see automatic voter registration. You see, you know, solar energy tax credits, electric vehicles, access to contraception. There's paid family and medical leave, paid sick days. These things are all passing despite all that dark money. So I say, imagine, you know, if that's what we're doing at our current level of involvement and with the massive quantities of dark money on the other side, you know, imagine if 10% more of your, you know, of the American electorate or five of the American populace, I should say, electors and non-electors, if, you know, 5% more of the people listening to the radio went out, you know, went to a protest, gave a few bucks to their, you know, favorite political group, emailed their legislator, you know, just took a few simple actions over the next month. I mean, it's not, it's not onerous. It's you know, half an hour of your time, maybe. And, you know, imagine how much more we could accomplish, right? I think the conservatives have had their day. I think the pendulum has swung really far to the right. And if there's one thing that I think the long sweep of American history and American politics has taught us, it's that, you know, the pendulum swings back, right? The pendulum swings back and forth. In the mid-70s, when Democrats controlled 37 state legislatures and Republicans controlled five, and Nixon had just got resigned and progressives had huge majorities in Congress, you know, it seemed like the conservative movement would never be in power again. And yet, of course, we know over 40 years, the pendulum swung back. And I think there's no question that the pendulum will swing. The hope is just that we can all, you know, push it a little bit more quickly and get it to swing a little bit faster so we don't have to wait another 40 years.
And on that note, we'll end. That's all the time we have. Sam Munger of the State Innovation Exchange, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.